Hi, we're continuing just our discussion of yesterday. How many commandments are in the Ten Commandments? So you'll recall that in the third commandment, so to speak, there are actually three different commandments. The prohibition against making or constructing idolatrous objects, that's lo saseh. The second is worshiping idols in a way that shows them respect, like bowing down. And the third is worshiping an idol even in a way that denigrates the idol, if that is the derech that its worshippers do, such as defecation to Baal Peor. And the chiddush of this is different than the second commandment. The second commandment prohibits belief in the idols. The third commandments prohibit external action of worship, even if you don't believe it, such as you're afraid for your life or whatever. Okay, now we then go on to the third dibor, the third commandment, but it's not really a third commandment because it's actually the sixth commandment, if you're counting the mitzvahs. And that is, lo sisa, do not take the name of God in vain. And then the Torah gives a reason. For God shall not exonerate he who takes God's name in vain. Remember that pasuk. Lo sisa. So there's only one prohibition there. Do not take the name of God in vain. But the truth of the matter is, there's a lot of machlokas, a lot of uncertainty. What does this actually prohibit? According to many Rishonim, this is not referring to simply saying God's name in vain. Rather, this refers to swearing in God's name if the oath is going to be false. Meaning, according to many Rishonim, this is not a prohibition against simply saying God's name in vain. I'll discuss, is that prohibited and what's the source? But according to many Rishonim, this is a prohibition against the making of a false oath. Now, there are three types of false oaths. One type of false oath, because an oath is said in God's name. I make an oath, I swear by God's name. One category is you swear about the past in a false way. If a person were to say he swears by God that he was in New York yesterday. If he was not, he has sworn falsely with the name of God. The second is an oath about the future that you don't fulfill. A person makes a shvua, I will meet you tomorrow at 1 o'clock. You shouldn't do that, but you said, and then you don't show up. Now that's also a false oath, but it's a little different. It's not a lie at the time you said it, but it becomes a lie because you didn't keep your promise. That's why we always say b'li neder, etc. Right, so both of them are called sheker. One is a sheker about the past, and the other is a sheker in the sense of not keeping your commitment. But you use God's name, that's the thing. Right? You swore by God's name. Now the third is different. The third is not called sheker. The third is called shav, which means vanity. And that refers to even if you swear truthfully, but it's so obvious that it's a waste of God's name, so to speak. So if one were to swear that this is a glass of water, unless there's some question, some people think it's vodka, you know, maybe that would be one thing. But if everybody knows it's water, then that is called an oath in vain. And Targum Unkelus says, the reason why it says in vain twice, do not take the name of God in vain, for God shall not exonerate he who takes his name in vain. The first vain is the vanity of sheker, and the second vain is the vanity of superfluous. Both of them are great sins because you are swearing by God's name to that which is either untrue or that which is superfluous. Now, by implication, here's an interesting point. Is it prohibited to swear in God's name if something is a true statement? The answer is, not only is it not prohibited, it is actually considered to be a mitzvah to swear in God's name to affirm the truth. And I'm not just talking about in court, even if it's a relatively minor thing. Let's say, for example, you accuse me of coming late to Seder in the morning. And I know that I was there on time today. So we would think, this sounds bad, but actually, according to the Rambam, if I would say, that the person swears by Hashem's name that I was here 9 o'clock in the morning. Now, we wouldn't look at that as the right thing to do, but the Rambam actually says you have fulfilled a commandment by swearing truthfully in the name of God. Now, why do we always tell people not to do that? That's simply because we're never sure we're 100% true. What if I came 9:05, or I don't mean 9:05, I mean 9 o'clock and 5 seconds. So as a result, the tendency in Judaism has been that we highly discourage any type of swearing, even if it's 100% true. But in reality, the Rambam says, if it is 100% true, it actually is a mitzvah. Now this actually explains a phrase you might have encountered in Gemara. I don't know if the Rebbe even translated it properly, but sometimes a rabbi will say something, and someone says, I don't think he said that. So there'll be a lesson, Ho'elokim, by God's name, he said that. That is actually an oath. The person swore by the name of God, and that was considered okay, because if you're swearing to the truth, the Rambam actually says it is a mitzvah. Okay? But as I say, our custom is we don't do that mitzvah because we're so afraid that, God forbid, it would not be truthful. And then what becomes a mitzvah becomes a very, very, very severe avera of taking God's name in vain. Yeah.
We learned last night in Halakha that you can recite a single pasuk as many times as you like and it's a mitzvah every single time, but yep. If you just did that ad infinitum, wouldn't that be vanity
and superfluity? No, it would not, because as long as you're thinking about what you're saying, so every word is a word of Torah. So that's why you're 100% correct. When you're reading psukim, you're allowed to say God's name. It's considered to be proper. That's whether you're reading from the Chumash, or even if you're reading from Gemara that has a pasuk. Now, what's interesting... Yeah.
So if you make a promise and then... at the time you have the resources to fulfill that promise, but then you don't anymore when the time comes about, are you accountable for a broken vow?
Yes, you absolutely are. You absolutely are, and that is why we always say, without a vow, bli neder. It makes no difference. The fact that you don't have the money later, or whatever it is, makes no difference. You made that promise. You have to keep it. Now, I want to point out that what about the concept of a blessing in vain, right? We say a person should not... when you're in doubt whether you made a blessing, generally speaking, we say don't make the bracha, because if you already said the bracha, it would be a bracha levatala. So according to many Rishonim, bracha levatala is not a doraisa. And the reason is, let's say it's shakol. If I say, blessed art you God that created everything, even if I say it a million times, even without drinking, it's a form of prayer. According to some Rishonim, it is absolutely not a Torah violation, and it's forbidden rabbinically, meaning it's not nichlal in lo sisa, because a blessing to Hashem is never considered to, on a doraisa level, is never considered to be in vain, and that which we prohibit unnecessary blessings is only an iser d'rabbanan, that's Tosas Shita. The Rambam Shita, however, is that when you say a blessing in vain, you do transgress lo sisa, right? So there's a big, big machlokes if this prohibition against taking God's name in vain applies to bracha levatala. It certainly applies, absolutely, it applies to oaths, and it's a machlokes if it applies to a blessing in vain. Now, what about stam, mentioning Hashem's name? So, for example, we always say Hashem, right? We don't pronounce the Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud. We say Elohim. We don't say it with the hay. If I were to say Elohim with the hey, or if I were to pronounce Aleph Dalet Nun Yud, would I, and not in the context of a bracha or a prayer or a pasuk, would I be over on Lo Sisa? So again, many Rishonim say no, Lo Sisa is not referring to simply saying God's name in vain. Now, saying God's name in vain is prohibited based on another pasuk, which says, you shall fear God, you should have reverence for God, and saying Hashem's name for no reason is a violation of the reverence obligation, but it may not be Lo Sisa. So Lo Sisa is potentially a fairly narrow set of prohibitions that are primarily dealing with false oaths, and some say with unnecessary, superfluous brachos. Yeah.
Like once I was at a bike store and I asked him to do some repairs, and I said, how much is it going to be? He said, 120 blue netter. And I said, well, like, how much is it going to be? Is it going to be more than that? And he said, I don't know, because Rosh Hashanah will be 120. So this is pretty fine for like Hamish Israel. But when you're working with non-Jews and you're working with people, they want to necessarily know more than like, and they don't want you saying like weird Hebrew words after you're saying a deal with them. So
well,
when it comes to making shvum, which
no, no, the truth of the matter is that you should say Bli Neder when you can, but the truth is Bli Neder is really superfluous, because the concept basically is something is not a Neder unless you said I'm making a Neder. So if you say something and you don't say it's a Neder, Bli Neder is actually automatic.
Okay.
But now still it's better to put Bli Neder in, but most of the time even without a Bli Neder it is a Bli Neder.
So you're trying. You're speaking to someone who's not Jewish, and you say, "Yeah, I'll have it done by Thursday."
Yeah, it's not.
It's Rosh Hashanah. I mean, can you say? They're looking for.
Well, with God's help. Say with God's help. Yeah, I mean that's fine. That's. I mean, you know, what do they want? I mean, they're against that. If they're against that too, they say, "I don't care. I want something more definite than that." Well, yeah. You can't give something more definite than that with Hashem's help. I'm going to try. But as I say, Bli Neder is a very proper chumrah, but it is a chumrah because things don't become neder or shvua unless you say that term. So usually Bli Neder is not necessary. The one exception, there is an exception where you need to say Bli Neder, is that when you're embarking on an observance of a mitzvah or a chumrah. So let's say you decided you're only going to drink Chalav Yisrael, even when you go back to America. Or you decided that you're going to stand up for Chazaras Hashatz. You know, we do in yeshiva anyway. Or you've decided that you're going to daven Vasikin. You're going to daven with the sunrise. So there is a rule that when you start doing mitzvahs and you've done it three times, you've locked yourself into a vow unless you specifically say, I'm doing it without a vow. So that's the one case when it's a Devar Mitzvah where you need to stipulate that, you know, I'm doing it, but I'm not doing it with a vow, so if I have to change my practice, I'm going to do so. Now, if you found yourself stuck in that way, if you didn't do that, so what you need to do is, you need to go in, that's not that difficult, that you need to go in front of three people, they could even be, you know, three students of the center, and basically say, I did something without saying Bli Neder, and I did not intend to make it a vow, and then they say, Mutar Lach, it is permitted for you, Mutar Lach, Mutar Lach, and then they've absolved you of the vow. Yeah.
So even if you had like a few days off yeshiva, and you just for those days you started going to Nates, and then but you knew it wasn't a long term thing in your mind, you've still made a vow.
Well, these are questions. I mean, sometimes the argument would be you never intended. That's very, very true. But generally speaking, it's better to be strict and to have hatorah called hataras nedarim, the annulment of a vow.
You should do that.
Yes, you should. You should. Yeah.
So even if you didn't know that you needed to add the Bli Neder at the end of it, you still are obligated to the vow for three times. And you're
if it's a mitzvah observance, as I say. So in a business transaction, you don't have to say Bli Neder.
Right.
But for mitzvah observances, after three times, it morphs into a Neder. That's the way it works. Now, by the way, I hope you understand that things are being subtle here, because technically, when you violate Neders, you're actually not violating this commandment, because this commandment only involves when you use the name of God. In the case of Neder, you didn't use the name of God. So you're dealing really with another prohibition. Lo yachel devaro, you should not desecrate your word. In other words, it's not this one, although it's obviously closely linked. This one is triggered only when you use the name of God. Now, many vows don't use the name of God, so they wouldn't be involved with this prohibition. But at the end of Bamidbar, we have a general prohibition that you must keep the vows and the oaths that you make. Yeah.
So for clarification, you don't have to actually say, I'm taking that name. Even if you say it in your head and then you do it three times, that's as if you take on the name.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Can you say Blin Netter after each time?
Yeah, you can say it after each time, or you can just say the first time. You could say, I feel like going to Nate's this week because I'm getting up early. But you just say, but I'm not doing it to be a Nate. You don't have to say it every time. You say it once, and that'll cover you. Yeah.
For Paul Israel, what would be considered?
Yeah, that actually is a very good question. It is sometimes difficult to measure what is called three times. Now, something like Vasikin, pretty simple. If I went to an early minyan Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, that's three times. Standing up for Chazaras Hashas, standing up for Torah reading, putting on Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, if any of you would do that, three times. You know, that becomes a netter. But Chol Yisrael is a little difficult. Are we talking about what, three cups of coffee? But I mean, I would have had the coffee anyway. Is it the fact that I had three cups of coffee without using, chalav geisha milk? Well, I mean, plenty of people who don't keep chalav Yisrael, drink coffee. That's the milk that's around. I mean, here in yeshiva, right? You only get chalav Yisrael. So what's going to happen here? I had milk for 3 days in my cereal. So now, I'm told, hey, you're going back to Alaska, but you got to find chalav Yisrael. Yeah. So that actually is a very good question. It would have to be that you turned down something that you would have eaten because it was chalav akum three times. It wouldn't just be I had three drinks of chalav Yisrael and that's gonna be mechayiv. But that is an interesting question. Yeah.
Are you saying these three times have to be consecutive?
They have to be consecutive. Yeah. Basically. Okay. So I still remember. I remember my Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Bridiman Zichrono Livracha. The minhag of yeshivas is, and a lot of shuls we don't do that, but minhag of yeshivas is that we stand up, as you know, for the Chazaras Hashatz, and most people stand up for Kriyas HaTorah. That's the minhag of yeshivas. Again, in many shuls, that's not the case. So I remember that one Rosh Hashanah, besides the generic Hataras Nadarim that we make for the unknown vows, my Rosh Yeshiva was getting old, and he felt he couldn't stand up for the long Chazaras Hashatz of Rosh Hashanah. He did Hataras Nadarim, so he would be permitted to sit down during the repetition of the Amida. So, so even something like that. I know of Chaim Knievsky also, different things. Different chumras that he had, different practices that he had, that he felt because of his age and health, he was not able to do, so he would do Hataras Nadarim. He would get an annulment of the Neder. So he would not have to do certain practices. Of course, with great tzaddikim, what they often do is this. This is very interesting. They get it. They release themselves from the netter, but they continue to do it anyway. In other words, they want to have an insurance policy in case I'm very tired or weak. I want to be able to sit, but then they force themselves to stand up even afterwards. So they don't take advantage of the Hataras Nadarim, but at least they give themselves Hataras Nadarim. Okay. So this is something to be aware of. Even something like even something relatively minor, like wearing a hat. Right? You wear a hat three times, you're going to be stuck. Oh yeah, yay! You have to wear a hat, for mincha or whatever it is. So be sure you do Hataras Nadarim, so you don't have to be stuck with a hat. Okay. Anyway, nothing wrong with stuck with a hat, but okay. Now we now go to the fourth commandment. So one second. So how many commandments do we have? We've only done three, but commandment one. I am the Lord your God, that's Emunah. Commandment 2, don't believe in idols, that's 1-to-1. Commandment 3 is 3. Don't make the idols, don't bow to the idols, and don't worship the idols in a denigrating way. So, 1, 2, 3, we now have 5. Commandment number 3 is 1, don't take God's name in vain. So in the first 3 commandments, I say Dibros, the first 3 Dibros, we have 6 commandments. 6 commandments in the first 3 Dibros. Okay? Alright. We now come to the fourth Dibor, which is the longest one. And that is, of course, remember the day of Shabbos to keep it holy. Zachor es Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho. Now here, actually, there's a rabbi in Atlanta. Some of you may have heard of him or know him. He lives here in Israel now. Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, very very chashuv rabbi. His son now is the rav in Atlanta. So Rabbi Feldman tells a story that he talked about the tribulations of being a rabbi to sometimes a largely non-religious community for many many years. That there was a woman who used to come over just to schmooze with him. You know, she didn't have any particular questions, but, you know, come by, you know, in the South people like to talk, and, you know, and sometimes he was very, very busy, but, you know, he had to be nice, and she would just come, and she always had a very similar line. She was always something like, well, Rabbi, I'm not as religious as you, but I do keep the Ten Commandments. And this was kind of a line a lot of people say, you know, I don't keep all the stuff, but I keep the Ten Commandments. So he's busy writing, and he's very, very busy, and he said he was in a bad mood that day, and he shouldn't have talked to her a little impatiently. But he said to her, oh yeah, what about the fourth one? No, she says she keeps the Ten Commandments. Now when most people say they keep the Ten Commandments, they actually mean they keep the five commandments. They keep the last five. Don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery. You know, the fourth commandment is keep Shabbos. So anyone who doesn't keep Shabbos cannot say I keep the Ten Commandments. So he said, what about the fourth commandment? You keep the Ten Commandments. So she says, what's that? He says, remember the day of Shabbos to keep it holy. So she said to him, are you sure that's there? I don't remember that one, but okay. But this is the fourth commandment. Now, let me remind you about something, because this is the point that I think it's important to bring out. The Ten Commandments are actually written in two different places in the Torah. You know that. They are written in Exodus. We read it last week, Shmos. But they are also written in Sefer Devarim. You know, when Moshe Rabbeinu is reviewing the Torah with the Jewish people before his death, the book of Deuteronomy, he reviews the Ten Commandments. This is the new generation. This is the generation that was born in the desert, right? The old generation had died out. And by and large, the two versions of the Ten Commandments are virtually the same. They are 85% the same. But there are some differences between the version in Shmos and the version in Devarim. And the most important one is indeed how Shabbos is described. In the book of Shmos, it says, Zachor es Yom HaShabbos. Remember the day of Shabbos to keep it holy. Zachor. In Devarim, one word change. Shamor es Yom HaShabbos. Observe the day of Shabbos. Now, which did God say? Did God say this one, or did God say that one? We have two different versions. So this is the famous teaching of Chazal, Shamar and Zachar, B'dibur Echad. Hashem said both at the same time. Now, it's not possible for a human being to say two words at the same time. Sometimes HaKadosh Baruch Hu did it. So Hashem said both. Now, I want to clarify a common misconception. What a lot of people think, and some Forsham actually say, so I don't want to say it's totally illegitimate. They want to say, oh, you know why there are two versions of the Ten Commandments? Because there were two luchos, because there were the first tablets that were smashed in the sin of the golden calf, and then Moshe brought down the second luchos. So for whatever reason, it doesn't explain the differences, but that's why there are two versions. One is the luchos rishonos, and one is the Luchos Shnios. That's a common thing that people say, but I have to tell you that Lefi Pshat, that is absolutely incorrect, because if you look at the book of Devarim, when Moshe is reviewing what happened, he is describing the first Luchos. He is describing that, you know, there was Hashem appeared in the fire and the voice of God, which only happened the first Luchos. So it's not that the second version is the second Luchos. Rather, it's an alternative version of the first Luchos. And we say that Hashem said both at the same time. Now, what is the difference between, right? That's why in Lecha Dodi we say, Shamor v'zachar b'dibur echad. Now, what is the difference between the Zachar, halachically, between the Zachar of Yisrael and the Shamor of V'yeschanan? So Chazal tell us, Zachor are the positive aspects of Shabbos, in particular the obligation to recite Kiddush. in honor of Shabbos, and the Havdalah in honor of Shabbos when Shabbos leaves. So Kiddush is a Da'oraisa mitzvah. It's a mitzvah Da'oraisa. Now granted, the Rambam says, Kiddush on wine may be rabbinic. So Da'oraisa, you have fulfilled your Kiddush obligation in the Shemona Esrei? That may be so. But some type of words honoring Shabbos is a Torah commandment. That is Zachor. Shamar is the negative, refraining from doing Malacha. Right? Now, one could do one without the other, but their Shabbos is incomplete. If I sleep all day and I chain myself to my bed so I don't do any Malacha, I have fulfilled the Shamar of Shabbos. But I have not honored the Shabbos by prayer and by Shabbach to Hashem. If I make Kiddush and I have nice, good meals, I have fulfilled the remembering of Shabbos. But if I turn on lights and after benching I go drive to the movies, I'm violating the Shamar. So Shamar v'Zachar b'dibur echad doesn't just mean Hashem said it simultaneously, but it means both elements together must exist for Shabbos to be complete. Meaning if you're missing either aspect of Shabbos, there is something defective and incomplete. Now having said that, let me just say that we still say half a Shabbos is better than no Shabbos. Thank you. Which means even if, no, Lamaise, it's true, even if a guy is going to go to the movies after benching, let him make Kiddush and let him bench. And then go to the movies. Not that we want him to go to the movies, but to say, well, if I'm going to go to the movies, what's the point of making Kiddush? That's not a correct way of thinking. Because everything you do is a mitzvah, even if you're not doing the whole thing. Yeah.
Can a Shomer Shabbos Jew then invite someone who they'll know will be in the situation after they come to their house Friday night after the meal, they're going to drive?
Yeah, so that's a very, very excellent question, and it comes up a tremendous amount. In Kiruv, right? You want to invite people to a Shabbos meal, and the hope would be that they would be inspired by Shabbos and they would grow and they would, you know, maybe gradually keep Shabbos more and more. But you're going to be the cause. You're going to cause them to drive. Now, of course, let me just say that you certainly have to offer them the option of a place to stay for all of Shabbos. I mean, that's basic. If you don't have accommodations for them, then you cannot invite them. But assuming that from your perspective, you are ready and able to give them a comfortable place to stay for all of Shabbos. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach Paskin, this was a big shaila. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach Paskin, that you are permitted to invite them and even encourage them to come on the grounds that even though you might be causing a violation of Shabbos, but in all probability, number one, they would be violating Shabbos anyway. And number two, there is the potential for a long-term... Well, actually, three ideas. Number one, they would be violating Shabbos anyway. Number two, at least for the few hours they're in your house, they're keeping Shabbos and doing other mitzvahs like benching. And number three, there is a long-term potential that eventually they may get closer and closer and perhaps become Shomer Shabbos. And therefore, you're allowed to have them do a short-term sin if there is a prospect of a long-term benefit. Now that's tricky, because you have to differentiate between maybe a kiruv organization, or a yeshiva, or a shabbaton, versus I'm just inviting you because my kid's having a bar mitzvah. There are certain experiences that are not necessarily going to have a spiritual follow-up. And if they're not going to have a spiritual follow-up, then you know it's better for you not to cause Chilul Shabbos. But if there is the real potential of a long-term relationship, so Rav Shlomo Zalman matured it. Now, it's very interesting. There's a little history about this. For many, many years, the one who asked Rav Shlomo Zalman the Shaila was a person who used to be a Rebbe in Or Samech Menis. He's not here anymore. And he was very close to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And he asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, and he got a letter allowing it. But Rav Shlomo Zalman initially didn't want this letter to be publicized. So for many years, this was the secret Or Sameach letter. It was almost a little bit of a legend that, you know, you could only see the letter behind closed doors, you know, etc. And they would show you, they wouldn't show you. You couldn't see it at all, but you know, we could see the letter, you know, etc. And the like. But the truth is, the cat is out of the bag. It's now in volume one of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's Tshuva, so it's open, and no, it's not a secret anymore. It's funny, people were still talking about it like it was a secret letter 20 years after it was published. So it's not a big secret. This was his psak. And I'll give you another example, an analogous psak that he gave that makes the same point. Do you know there's a law in the Shulchan Aruch that you are not allowed to give food to somebody or liquid to drink to somebody if they're not going to make a bracha, because you're causing them to sin by eating without a bracha. So the Shulchan Aruch says b'feirish, I cannot give a secular Jew a glass of water if he's not going to make a bracha. So Shlomo Zalman said, imagine this situation. Your air conditioner breaks down in the middle of the summer. It's 95 degrees, it's 100 degrees outside. And you have a secular or non-religious repairman who comes in and he works an hour in the sun, hour and a half in the sun, to repair your air conditioning. If you were to follow the Shulchan Aruch literally, you could not give him a drink of water. Now Shlomo Zalman said, what's the problem? Because you're causing him to sin by not making a bracha. But if you don't give him the water, he's going to think that religious Jews are stingy, are hateful, are ungracious, and his hatred for what the way religious Jews behave is going to cause him to have many more averos than the other way. So Rav Shlomo Zalman said it is worthwhile, only a gadol could say such a psak, it is worthwhile to cause him to violate that one sin of eating and drinking without a bracha if that will give him a good impression of religious Jews that may make him amenable to perhaps, you know, raise his kids in a more positive way and the like. Meaning you have to look at the total picture. You can't just look at this particular scenario. So it's very consistent with his reasoning with the driving as well. This becomes a general problem. I mean, essentially the problem basically becomes, it's a much more wider problem than this, and that is, we're not supposed to cause people to sin, right? That's pashut. That's called lifnei iver. You don't cause people to sin. But what if by causing people to sin, you're actually minimizing sin in the long run? So maybe, again, you have to ask a shayla. These are not matters you decide by yourself. But sometimes it might be justifiable to cause somebody to do something wrong now if that is the mechanism that there'll be fewer problems in the future. Let me give you a third example, which is not exactly the same, but it's a very troubling example. It's a delicate example, so maybe I shouldn't even bring it up, but I'll bring it up just for your edification and contemplation. We know that Judaism is very much against sexual intimacy outside of marriage. Not allowed to do it, right? We know that. Not allowed to do it, right? That intimacy is for a husband and a wife. It's not for outside of that. Now, imagine you're a rabbi and you have this problem. You have a couple that are living together. They are not married. But they're going to do what they're going to do. They're not going to listen to you one way or the other on that. But they're interested in becoming more observant. They're interested in kashering their kitchen. They're interested in keeping Shabbos. Now, here you have to understand something. When two people are living together without benefit of marriage, on one hand, it's sinful because there's no marriage. But there's actually a much bigger aveira that's involved. And that is, if the woman did not go to the mikveh, and single women do not go to the mikveh today, it is not just the prohibition of singlehood that's being violated. It's the prohibition of the laws of nida, which is much more severe. So, can I as a rabbi, or should I as a rabbi, advise the single woman to go to the mikveh to at least take off the prohibition of nida? Now, this is a very, very difficult question. It's a very difficult question. Because on one hand, that almost seems as if you as a rabbi, as a halachic Jew, are giving a hechsher. You are legitimating the commission of an act that is a sinful act. And what gives you the right to kind of give a stamp of approval to to have people do things that are sins. Right? It's one, even if I'm not going to give mussar to them, but for me to actually give them a mechanism to keep on going. On the other hand, if the woman doesn't go to the mikveh, they are committing a very, very grave sin for which you're chayiv kares. If she goes to the mikveh, the sin gets downgraded to a negative commandment, granted, very serious, but you've helped them reduce the transgression. How does that work? In other words, is there an inyan that if people are sinning, to try to lower the level of the sin? Or is there a problem of giving a hechsher to a sinful act? It's similar, again, there's a very similar problem in the secular world. Baruch Hashem, we don't really have it in the Jewish world so much. That is the issue of giving condoms to high school kids so they shouldn't get AIDS. Now, obviously, this is predicated on them doing immoral things. So why should I give them a condom to help them do immoral actions? On the other hand, if they're going to do it anyway, at least I'm saving a life. Right? Right? So there's that type of problem. Yeah.
But isn't it also an issue once you make it known to them? Because now, they at least, like, before, they had no idea, like, a secular Jew doesn't know Adidas, doesn't know that you can't drive, like, some people don't even know you can't drive on Shabbos. Some people. So once you make it known to them, then it may even become...
Yeah, you are correct. There you have another issue. That better if people are going to sin, it's better that they sin inadvertently than intentionally. But that's not my case, because in my case, the woman would be willing to go to the mikveh if she'd be given the option.
No, so,
you're talking about a different case. You're talking
if
about
he wants to come over to you on Shabbos.
Yeah.
You're going to say no, like he doesn't know that he shouldn't drive on Shabbos.
I hear you. That's true, and that is a factor. There is a halachic principle that if people are going to sin anyway, no matter what you say, it is sometimes better not to tell them, because then the severity of their sin is much less, because they're acting out of ignorance and not out of rebellion. Yeah.
Going back to the example about giving somebody a drink if you know they're not going to make a bracha, if you knew that they weren't going to make a bracha on their own, could you have yourself a glass of water and say a bracha on his, with him in mind?
Yeah, that's a very good idea, but there's one limitation, and that is, in order... I could make a bracha for somebody else if I'm drinking also, 100%, but he has to have intention. So I have to tell him, I can't just make a bracha, I have to tell him, I'm making this bracha for you as well. And if he's agree, if he's not hostile and he agrees... then that's a very, very good solution, 100%. But sometimes, if he's a real diehard chiloni, he might say, don't put your religion stuff on me, you know. So it's not always going to work that way, yeah.
So you have, some relatives, like distant relatives, I didn't actually know what the story was, but I know that they were married. They're both Jewish, halachically Jewish, and they were married not secularly. And then they became firm together, and then they were like a yeshivish... Anyway, I know they had like a second wedding.
Yeah.
But do we say to them that you should not? I don't know what the deal was with them. But do we, in the case, would you say to a people who have been married for 2, 3, 4 years, however long they're married, now you have to observe hilchos yichud and you can't touch each other until we have the halachic marriage?
Well, it depends. You know, once again, it would depend on the issue of shogeg versus mate. You know, if they're going to be over, no matter what you tell them, then maybe better not to tell them. But otherwise, absolutely. If they're ready, they're ready. And in fact, I've had that experience myself, where people who were civilly married or reform married or whatever it is became balei tshuva, and they did observe, you know, separation and the like. So, you know, depends on what they're ready to do. All righty, you take care and have a good Bein Hazmanim a little bit.
Yeah. Bye. Bye.